easy.
Makes it easy.
Good morning, everyone. Yeah. Welcome to our House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this fine day. Where are we? We are Friday, January 15th. We have kind of a varied agenda this morning. Our first order of business is to open an informational hearing on two bills that I would consider kind of cleanup bills from the last session. The first is an introduction of committee members LC68, LC102, and LC135. And the informational hearing will open with an informational meeting on LC-168. We passed a bill in the last session that raised speed limits in certain eastern and southern Oregon counties, and Paul Mather is here today and Representative Barreto to talk about some technical details that we would like to clean up. So, gentlemen, please join us if you like. Mr. Mather, you're welcome to join us, too. I know Representative Barreto is up on the details and will enlighten us as to how we can make this a better bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Davis, and Vice Chair Gorsuch and committee. This is a correction, and actually I have LC-68, not 168.
I'm sorry, LC-68.
Okay.
Thank you.
And this is from our House Bill 3402-7 from last year, which increased the speed limit on interstate from the Dalles over to Ontario, and then several different highways, state highways. The main one here, dealing with the Dalles down to Klamath Falls, and extending it. We ended it at Klamath Falls, and that was an omission because there's another 15 miles that goes from Klamath Falls down to the California border. So one part of this bill just extends that down to the California border. The other part of this extends Highway 82 or Interstate 82 just before Hermiston that goes up to where it crosses the river into Washington, right there at McNary Dam. So all it is a cleanup bill. It fixes those two areas that were basically an omission.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Mather, do you have anything to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. Good morning, members of the committee. Just a couple of things. I'd point you to the map that's in there. I think Representative Barreto did a good job explaining it, but I think you can see it visually, just the small areas that we're talking about. The other thing I think you can see visually is we're, with this omission, you're actually kind of creating a speed trap where you're at a higher speed outside of the state, and then you come into the state, and then you go back up again. So it's kind of a legislative speed.
Coming for a short, brief
for a real
section
short,
of highway,
for a real short segment,
which is why it's problematic.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
Okay. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
No,
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both. Representative Barreto, how much faster did you get here today?
Actually, I was subject to the speed limits here in Salem.
Oh!
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you bringing this correction. You know, we don't always get it just perfect when we bring bills, and that's what the short session is for, is to fix these little things that pop up as we implement this legislation. So I appreciate you introducing this topic today, and this will be a committee bill. We'll move it forward and see you again during the session.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Mather, anything else? Okay, thank you. The next committee measure is LC-102, and I would like to call up Mitch Zwecker. Oh, I'm sorry. You guys, I have a cold. Mm-hmm. I can't talk, and I'm going to apologize for the condition that I'm finding myself in these last few days. LC-102. JTA project funding reallocation. Mr. Mather, thank you so much for being here. Again, one of our little fix-its from the last session that we're rolling out as a committee bill.
Madam Chair, again, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. This is a bill we've had, I think, virtually every session since the Jobs and Transportation Bill passed in 2009, both the full session and the short sessions. As you recall, I've testified on numerous times, but in the Jobs and Transportation Act, those projects were put in statute. So anytime we change scope or schedule or scope or budget of those projects, we have to come back and make a legislative change. And so again, here I'm actually good news in that we've had savings on one of our projects, the Woodburn project. We had a great contractor, K&E, out of Salem, saved a year on that project, and we've saved significant amount of money on the project. And now we're asking to move those to two other JTA projects, following our discipline that we've used or followed in all the changes. Keep the savings on the original list of projects and keep them in the same region of the state. And so our recommendation and our commission's recommendation is to move the funds from the Woodburn project to the Kubla project on I-5 and the project in Tillamook.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair Paul. Thanks very much. Can you talk about what's the need for additional funds on these projects? So great that we came under budget on one, but are we over budget on the others?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, the one in Tillamook, we're just now starting construction on. In fact, I think we go to bid this spring on that project. It's a project in the downtown core of Tillamook. So a lot of unknowns. It was probably, of all the JTA projects, probably the least known or at least far developed when we passed the bill in 09. In fact, I think it'll be the last or one of the last projects that go to bid because of that. And so we just know a lot more about the project as we work with the community, did the design, and understood what was needed for the project. The project in Kubler, we actually found an opportunity to add additional third lane on the freeway. As you see, the construction that K&E's been doing out there, we're extending the third lane further to the south. We saw an opportunity with the sound wall mitigation that we're doing, as well as the other improvements. Just saw an opportunity where we could apply some of the savings on one project and add scope to another project.
And to follow up.
Yes, sir.
And these are all staying in the same region. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Yep. And one more question.
Yes, sir.
And some might be surprised that a 2009 bill we're just now bidding in 2016 for projects. So can you talk about the timing and why that's the case? So for Tillamook,
yeah,
for example,
yeah,
you say it's not,
Chair,
it's not going out to
Davis,
bid now.
I think for Tillamook, I think I walked through. We hadn't done any of the preliminary work on Woodburn, for example. We'd done a lot of work, and we've been working on Woodburn for some time, working with the community. We understood the design, understood what was needed. And so that project is actually complete, had ribbon cutting last summer. There's a lot of the JTA projects are going to be wrapping up. You'll see my report later on in the agenda today talking about the status of most of those. Tillamook, we've always known as the one that was going to be at the tail end just because we hadn't done that preliminary work in that community.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure what this is, but I was just reading that paragraph, just glancing at it on page 4, which moves the money from line 2L, and then it says 2J, but I don't think it's 2J. Is it 2O? It looks like there's a typo.
Okay.
So in line 1, it should be 2O instead of 2J. Okay.
Thank you. We'll look into that.
Or there may be one that's can get it over to my area and make it 2H.
Always watching out for his district, Representative Benz.
Yes, yes.
Vice Chair Gorsuch, questions?
No, thank
Anyone
you
else have questions
for the information, Paul.
Nope.
Again, one of those fixes that we need to take care of as we clean up. Thank you, Mr. Mather. I am going to close the informational meeting and open a work session. And I am going to turn to Vice Chair Davis. What we would like to do now are introduce our three committee bills. And we have one other bill we're adding. It is LC-135. It is a placeholder bill for economic development should something come forward that we need to work later in the short session. So it's just a placeholder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the following LC Legislative Council drafts be introduced as committee bills. LC-68, dated 12-14-15. LC-102, dated 12-23-15, and LC-135, dated 12-3-15, all of which are in the record in OLIS.
Thank you. Vice Chair Davis moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC-168, LC-102. I'm sorry. I've got that in my head, and now it's not coming out. LC-68, LC-102, and LC-135. Is there any discussion on our three committee bill introductions? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Thank you all. And now we'll move into a substantive part of our agenda for today, informational hearings. We're going to start with LC-116. This is a property tax incentive for brownfield cleanup. This is a discussion we had in the last session. It's returning in a simplified version, and I will turn to Mr. Tucker from Metro to give us an kind of the update on where this bill is and why it's important that we look at this brownfield redevelopment opportunity. Thank you for being here, Mr. Tucker.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
LC-116, not 16. I'm trying to behave.
Hi, I'm Randy Tucker. I'm with the Legislative Affairs Manager with Metro. I guess first little piece of business. I just went on OLIS, and the version of the bill that's on OLIS is a couple of days old, and there's a new version that's only about 17 hours old, and it's up. Never good. I emailed it into your staff, who are on top of it. Thank you. As you know, I appeared before you several times last session on behalf of the Brownfields Coalition and with other members of the Brownfields Coalition, which formed in 2014 and consists of over 40 groups that have come together to work on addressing this problem around the state. The members of the Brownfields Coalition represent public sector, private sector, and nonprofit community sector groups. And we've had a really great experience working together, and we were successful in passing a couple of bills or a couple of our priorities last session. One of the bills that we brought forward last session included language similar to what's before you today and this session. It authorized local governments to establish a program to provide property tax incentives in order to facilitate brownfield cleanup and redevelopment. That was included in the same bill that had the land bank authority piece that did pass, but as the session went on, this piece was very difficult to draft initially. We had a lot of, we had about three different, completely different approaches to it based on conversations with various stakeholders, including the assessors, the county assessors. Ultimately, as the session wore on, we just realized we didn't have it right. We had both technical problems and political problems, and that combination is usually toxic, especially late in a session, and it was, in this case, we voluntarily pulled back. Actually, the coalition decided, well, let's wait until 2017 to do this, but we've been urged to move more quickly and have been collaborating with your chair and your vice chair, Representative Davis, with their urging, have actually, I think, put together something pretty straightforward and workable. And that's before you today. I want to be clear, this is not the coalition's bill. This is your members' bill. And the coalition as a whole has not yet met to discuss this, but there is a legislative committee of the coalition, and there's a subcommittee of that legislative committee that is the property tax committee, and we have been working closely with your members to get this right, and I'm very confident that when the coalition meets between now and the beginning of the session that we'll be supporting this legislation, but that hasn't happened yet. Just briefly, what this bill does is, as I said, it authorizes a local government, which is defined as a city, a county, or a port, to adopt a resolution or ordinance that would create a program authorizing or providing property tax incentives to landowners for cleanup and redevelopment of contaminated properties. Last session, we only were focused on what's called a special assessment on the land, but we realized that was not an adequate incentive given Oregon's property tax system. So this bill would authorize both a special assessment on the land value and also an exemption on the value of improvements and personal property. The total incentive, however, would be capped at the cost of cleanup, so there wouldn't be any way for this to be a runaway program where people would be saving way more than they spend. The program would allow local governments to offer this incentive for up to 10 years. They could choose to make it shorter, and it would give them the opportunity to extend the program to develop their ordinance to allow them to extend their program for 5 years, according to criteria that they determine at the local level. The cleanup would have to be conducted in collaboration with DEQ. In other words, under the subject to an agreement or an order or a process or a program that is authorized by the DEQ. So it's not just free floating out there. I want to emphasize this is completely optional for any local government. They can choose not to adopt this program, and if they do adopt it, there is a lot of flexibility in how they can implement it. There's language in the bill that gives them explicitly the authority to do anything that's beyond what the bill itself provides. The tax incentives would only be available to landowners that had not caused or exacerbated the contamination on their property. So this is for people that find themselves owning a property that has contamination caused by somebody else, and so not for the actual polluters. And it excludes a certain categories of properties, including federal Superfund sites and centrally assessed properties, and properties that are appraised by the state as opposed to the local tax assessors. And so it lays out the application procedures and the eligible costs that can be included, and clawback procedures in case of violations. And it has a sunset. It's a long sunset, but we decided to add that, which we didn't have in the bill last session. And so that's a summary of the bill at a high level, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions with my 17 hours of familiarity with the current draft.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker. Yes, Ms. Representative McLean.
Thank you. I really appreciate this coming back to us. I think it's important. I think that we know how very, very important it is to recycle land and also to clean up problems that we have with activity that has been done in our communities. And the two things that I wanted to ask, first of all, I think the sunset's a good idea because that means that we'll review it and we'll be able to update it and make it the most efficient possible if it passes. Second, I didn't understand one of your last comments, and I hadn't read this new draft until just you brought it in today. So what is the deal about we're only looking at land that is assessed by local assessment versus state assessment?
That could be better explained, unfortunately, not by somebody other than me.
Okay.
There are certain large industrial properties that I believe the valuation has to be over $100 million or something like that. Mm-hmm. Is that, I'm sorry?
$1 million.
$1 million. Yeah. That's what I meant. $1 million.
It was clear.
Yeah, it's close.
Yeah. Different.
Right, right.
I can't claim I have a cold, unfortunately. Yeah. But large industrial properties that are assessed by the State Department of Revenue rather than by local tax assessors. I don't actually know that program, and I'm not the best person to answer the question, but it seemed like that's a category of that just seemed sort of different, and it was recommended by the Department of Revenue staff person that was helping us with technical aspects of this this work.
That helps me figure out what it is, at least, so I can look at it.
Vice Chair Davis.
That's a great question, and as part of the group putting this bill together, we were thinking, how do we make this narrow in scope to begin with and a tool that local communities could use? And so one way is there are exclusions in the bill, and one of which are state-appraised industrial property. The thinking behind that is these are properties that by their very nature are already in productive use because they have to be over $1 million, and there has to be an election by the local jurisdiction to have the state do the assessment. And the state's really only doing assessments on very valuable industrial property.
Okay.
So it excludes a category of property where we didn't want people to potentially game the system by maybe there's a very productive industrial plant and a corner of that plant that may have some remediation needs and allow an exemption for just the corner of a lot where really the intent of this program is to start narrow, to start with those true brownfields that are not in productive use, and to allow a tool in the toolkit of local governments to provide some incentive to property owners to get these back on the rolls.
Thank you.
It's all coming back to me now. Thank you.
Vice Chair Gorsuch has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So is that why Superfund sites are not part of this? Because we're trying to keep it narrow and for maybe more local, maybe like small lots? Or
that's part of the reason, Representative Chair McHugh and Vice Chair Gorsuch. In the general run-up to last session and the various pieces of legislation that the Brownfields Coalition brought forward, some of the members of the coalition were concerned that we'd be providing a tax incentive to people that were already being required under state or federal law to conduct a cleanup. And, you know, the intent of this is to have cleanups happen that aren't otherwise going to happen.
So small, for, really smaller things, right?
Well, smaller than federal Superfund sites,
right.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's part of. I think we added this that exception last session to make sure that, you know, we were all in agreement about where we should target this program.
That makes sense. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I haven't read through this very carefully, so I may not even know the correct question. I'm trying to understand the implications here for when there's more than one tax district, which there is, and I'll pick on, say, school districts along with cities, the role any of those other taxing districts have in this program. So if a city chooses, wants to do the program.
Right.
But there are other taxing districts that are implicated, so I'm trying to understand how that relationship or what's required of that.
Right. So this is the mechanism in this legislation is modeled after several other tax exemption programs. It requires that 51% of the taxable that districts representing 51% of the taxable value agree before this program can go forward. A taxable value within the jurisdiction that adopts the program. So if a city adopts it, that is all of the taxable value within the city, even if there are multiple school districts or, you know, multiple sort of, you know, separate non-overlapping districts. You need to have more than 51% of the overall value, districts representing that value agree before you can go forward.
Thank you.
Good. Anyone else? Mr. Tucker, I want to thank you. When we resurrected this idea, and your coalition stepped up and you stepped up, and I'm very grateful for your willingness to work with the vice chairs and myself to bring this forward again in a much more simplified fashion. I also want to make really clear this is a voluntary program. This is only for those entities that qualify if they choose to participate. And I think it's a really great opportunity to provide some support for getting some of those brownfields cleaned up across the state. This is a mechanism that can be used in every quarter. So I appreciate your work on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there have been a number of members of the lobby organizations are members of the coalition who participated in the nitty-gritty work of developing this draft. So there were several participants, and we're all happy to be working on it.
And please pass along on our behalf thanks to them for the work that they've done. And we'll look forward to having more conversations about this bill in
Great.
A few weeks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Our next informational hearing will be on LC 166, definition of a rural airport. And I believe we have Director Zwecker here to address us this morning. Enlighten us. Thank you for being here, Director. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitch Zwecker. I'm the director of the Department of Aviation. I'm here to discuss two technical changes, and I thank the chair and the committee for giving me the opportunity to talk about these. The first deals with Aurora Airport. We just completed an air traffic control tower at Aurora State Airport, which is what's called a through-the-fence airport. And being through the fence, it has private property. It's a great public-private venture, private property that abuts a federally funded airport that the state owns. In our case, our agency owns it. And by building an air traffic control tower, we now put it into the unintended consequences position of having a statute that says a through-the-fence airport cannot have an air traffic control tower. So the statute we'd like to change is 837, and it would just strike one line, paragraph 4A, out of it that says the clauses that says that a through-the-fence airport does cannot have an air traffic, a permanent air traffic control tower. We just want to strike that line out of there. So that's the first technical change. And if there's no questions on that, I'll go on to the second one.
Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one question. Why was that in the statute in the first place?
I don't know for sure because I wasn't around for that time frame. It could be because most air traffic control towers have commercial air service, and the through-the-fence access would be a prohibited behavior because then you have a security issue related to that. That could be the reason. There are two other towers in the state that don't have commercial air service, Hillsborough and Troutdale. My guess is that might have something to do with it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks very much for being here. What are the other, this is maybe opening a can of worms, but this would be amending the definition of rural airport. What are the, what comes with being a rural airport? Why is that even a definition?
Again, probably predates me. I suspect that it's designed to, in this context of through the fence, it was never envisioned that it would include airports like PDX, mm-hmm. Possibly some of the more urban airports. And for through the fence, it was designed this, and this is part of that clause, that it was probably part of the encompassing all of the airports that might benefit the most from a through the fence relationship. In our case, we have more revenue from through the fence airports. There are more jobs at the through the fence airports. It gives the state an opportunity, in our case the state, an opportunity to allow private investment that benefits from the relationship with a federally funded airport. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I can think of. I'll do a little more research if you think it's worthwhile.
I don't get it at all.
Yes, Vice Representative McClain.
Okay, I have never seen a definition yet that didn't matter to somebody. And when I look at legislation, there's always reasons for why you have definitions on, because you're usually trying to put either sideboards on something or you're trying to define something so people know who's responsible or who benefits. And so I just don't understand how all of a sudden this is not important. I'm being dense this morning? I don't know.
And Chair McEwen, Representative McClain, I don't have a good answer for the intent of why this was done in this particular way. I looked at the number of air traffic control towers in the state, and with the exception of Troutdale and Hillsborough, they all have commercial air service. So it may have been an attempt to exclude the commercial air service airports or maybe more urban airports. Mm-hmm. That's my only explanation. I looked at unintended consequences of removing this. I can't think of any because there are so few air traffic control towers in the state. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to through the fence airports, this would be the only one that I'm aware of that has an air traffic control tower. So it's under the definition of through the fence and rural that this even happens.
So how many air traffic control towers are there in the state of Oregon?
I want to say 7 or 8 if I count them individually. North Bend, Medford, Klamath Falls, Pendleton, Hillsborough, PDX, Troutdale, Salem, and now Aurora and Eugene.
Okay, and so Aurora is becoming kind of the poster child for this hybrid of some sort that's creating this problem.
It is the poster child for through the fence, probably in the nation, for how to do it well. Mm-hmm. And the evidence is clear. It's one of our most thriving airports, and it has about 1,000 jobs there, tremendous businesses that are working out there.
And so Representative Benz.
Thank you, and I think you just answered it, but the bill is being brought by Aurora. Is that who's bringing the bill?
Excuse me?
Who's bringing the bill?
I believe it's Representative Witt.
For whom? For what purpose?
To do these technical changes to the legislation.
But why?
Let's follow up. Yes, I understand that. Right. What client, constituent, person, entity ask him to bring the bill?
Chair McEwen, Representative Benz, That would be me. I had an opportunity to suggest technical changes in this particular case. It was pointed out to me that this would remove it from the statute of eligibility to be a through-the-fence airport.
Well, so then the only one that exists is Aurora. So would it make sense for you to conclude that Aurora asked for this?
As the sponsor for Aurora, yes, sir, that's true.
Thank you.
I got to read more. I got to look more and figure this out.
Representative McLean, did you have another question or comment?
I don't think I do. I think I need to read more and understand this better.
Well, this is just an informational meeting, so we will have a lot of time to digest and look at this in more depth as we enter the session. So this is just a first blush. We'll have plenty of time. Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there any problem with having a through-the-fence airport that has a tower? I guess that would be the question.
The way it's been explained to me is that there's a potential that because it's no longer included in the through-the-fence statute,
right,
that any additional growth or benefits at the airport could be challenged on land use basis.
Okay.
That it's no longer included under that statute as a through-the-fence. So additional through-the-fence.
This helps them define that relationship, right?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Director, maybe if we have people out there watching this from afar, I guess it might be wise to define through the fence and what that means. If you work in the aviation world, you understand it, but we may have folks out there that don't know what that means.
So, Chair McEwen, through the fence is a term that's used at both the federal and the state level. It was brought into Oregon under Senate Bill 680 several years ago. And the idea was to create a public-private venture that enables a company to invest in their own land in close proximity adjacent to an airport that is federally funded. And the benefits there, of course, are that the state, in our case, doesn't have a lot of revenue to do the kind of development that can take place that way. And the through the fence is the idea that you would have to go through a fence, although it's imaginary in actuality, that you have to go through a fence in order to get onto airport property. Mm-hmm. So the business from off airport goes through the fence to access the airport. And we charge a fee for access that really exceeds anything that we get from on-airport leasing.
And do you anticipate in the future that we may see more of this coming as things develop?
I think that it's a very beneficial relationship. The FAA is not fond of it, but they have been challenged by Congress to allow it. There are two types. There's residential and there's commercial. Aurora is a classic case for commercial, and Independence Airport in the state is a classic case for residential. The FAA actually went to ban residential through the fence about 4 years ago, and Congress intervened and put into the FAA, one of the FAA reauthorization bills, that they could not ban it, that they had to allow it. And again, this is another, what I think is very beneficial thing, and it's been very good for Oregon.
Great. Thank you. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chair McEwen. This won't add to the body of knowledge. I just have this question as I read this, because we start off with rural as a definition, and then we get this through the fence smaller. And in what it says here is rural is principally those that serve 500,000 or fewer in a city or metropolitan city, which if I have my figures correct, the only one that isn't rural is Portland.
Yeah. And Chair McEwen, Representative Lively, I think that is probably correct, that it's only excludes maybe the most urban city, probably Portland.
I think that's part, and in having this conversation, that's part of what confused when we're talking about rural. I have a different image of what rural is versus, and I'm not to argue this isn't correct, but I think that's where I started down this path trying to understand the purpose of this, because Aurora to me isn't Eugene or even Medford,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it seemed like they all fall under the same basic law.
And Chair McEwen, Representative Lively, I believe that's to make it more inclusive of cities that don't have a population as big as Portland.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you. I know we just passed the increase in the jet fuel tax, and thus there's more money floating about. And does this have any impact on that in the sense that there's a rural, is there a rural designation in what we passed? I don't want to go back and look. It seems like there was. And does this expand and allow Aurora to participate in perhaps some of those monies?
And Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz. Yes, there is some potential. There were three components of that bill. One is to provide grant assistance to airports around the state. Another is to assist with commercial air service to rural. That's the only one that has a rural definition to it, commercial air service around the state. And then the other last 25% is for state-owned airports to be able to do some infrastructure improvements that we haven't been able to do in the past. So from that perspective, it very well could. For example, in the airport master plan for Aurora, there's a plan to extend the runway by 1,000 feet, which will allow some larger aircraft to be able to fly in and out of that airport. So that addition or lengthening of the runway could use some House Bill 2075 dollars for that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around this, too. Is it, if we're cleaning up the rural airport definition to be able to include the tower, is it that we're trying to clean up the through the fence? And if the tower issue was there, how are you able to put up the tower? And is it that it has to do with the location, or is that an issue? Or are we going to have these pop up in other locations, and is it the tower? And if that is the issue, obviously it was put there for a reason, and maybe it was that that some of these locations of these airports, they didn't want to have a tower, and then all of a sudden we take that out of statute, and then we start having towers pop up. And if this is going to be attractive to other cities, is that going to be an issue for us to take that out? And then we're going to have other people come back in here and say, we didn't want this tower. Now we've got a tower in our city. And so I'm just curious if it's what's the connection between the rule, the through the fence, and the tower? Because it's really about this tower issue.
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack. So the first issue I would say is that air traffic control towers are incredibly difficult to get funded and built. The FAA is very reluctant to provide that. Around the state, there are very few airports that would meet the requirements for an air traffic control tower. Aurora was one of them because it had about 400 based plus based aircraft, close to 100,000 operations a year. There were safety concerns that impacted me. The business community thought it would improve the ability of the airport to cater to the corporate clients. Around the state, I don't know of the existing airports that have towers. Some wouldn't qualify for them now. The only other airport that I can think of in the state that could qualify because they have the traffic right now is probably Bend. And that's, to me, an air traffic control tower is a safety issue, and the FAA, as I said, is very reluctant to fund them, and they have funded very few. As a matter of fact, in the FAA today, there are very few people still around who have actually started one. There was one started in Texas about 3 years ago, and then this one. So there hasn't been a lot of tower air traffic control towers added to the inventory around the country.
Okay, now.
And I think I hit all of your
I think we're getting more confused. Director, how many through the fence operations do we have in Oregon?
I'd say there's about four.
Okay.
Maybe a couple
of
more. I'd have to go back and do an inventory.
And what happens if we don't pass this legislation? What are the ramifications of not doing this?
And Chair McEwen, I think the only one might be land use and expansion of current through-the-fence use at Aurora, because it now no longer meets the statutory requirement of not having an air traffic control tower. And that was an unintended consequence of building the tower. That we didn't see that was going to be a consequence that it would no longer fit the through the fence criteria.
All right, thank you, Representative McLean.
Well, now, after all of that explanation, I am absolutely convinced that the definitions mean everything. And looking at Section 1 and then going down to Line 7 and Line 10 give you a start to understanding why that definition is important to Aurora. But there are implications that are quite large here that have to do not just with ability to develop, but also with understanding. Because under one, if you look at it, it says airport boundary includes the combined public and private properties that are permitted to have direct access to any airport runway by aircraft. And so, I mean, there's a lot of implications there, both safety and land use. And so I would appreciate, I think, a PowerPoint, backup speakers, and all kinds of good information on why we should do this, because there's so much to do on how it affects other things that are on the books already. And that's not just in the development or land use world, but also in responsibility and safety of airports in general. Because when you bring more activity or you bring more homes to an area where there's big planes and a lot of air traffic issues, you know, we've got a lot to talk about. So this sounds exciting. We're going to have fun. This is good.
Thank you, Representative McLean. Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks again for your testimony. Can you talk about what, in practice, for example, at Aurora or other through-the-fence airports, what does that relationship look like? And I'm specifically thinking about what are the types of businesses and operations at Aurora, and why is this a beneficial relationship for them? I mean, you've said it's a good example, but let's hear those examples.
Certainly. Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Davis. So I'll use Aurora as the poster child. There are, as I said before, 1,000 jobs there, a number of businesses and satellite businesses. Columbia Helicopters, Helicopter Transport Service, both two of the three largest heavy lift helicopter companies in the country are both based there. Metal Innovations, which is a company that caters to both of those companies and provides manufacturing and repair services to them, as well as to a number of other things, is also based right there. Vans Aircraft, which is the largest kit-built manufacturer in the world, is based right there. And that cluster of aircrafts and the group at the south end of the airpark there that is through the fence, has access to the runway, provides a tremendous economic benefit to the county and to the local community. A lot of the companies there, HTS, has people come in from all over the country. They brought their entire business into the state of Oregon and to Aurora, consolidated all of their national business there. And they come in and stay a lot in hotel rooms. They buy a lot of meals. They cater to the parts. Metal Innovations has a lot of providers of parts to them. Vans Aircraft has a lot of providers of parts in the local community, Wilsonville and Clackamas County and Canby and some of the other areas there. So there's a tremendous number of businesses there, and it's all largely through the fence generated. We have a lot of tenants on airport, but nowhere near the type of employment and opportunity that the through-the-fence companies bring to that airport.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to clarify, in my district, we have the lovely Troutdale Airport, which is a marvelous airport. But, of course, Aurora, Hillsboro, Troutdale all have to also, probably Aurora needs the tower because of the PDX traffic that's over the top of it, mm-hmm. I would think.
That's a part of it, Representative Gorsuch. In my opinion, when I first came to the agency, the big concern was that a lot of traffic, because it's such a busy airport, right. A lot of the traffic that comes in, instrument traffic from the north, not necessarily PDX, but flies straight into a traffic pattern that right. may be operating to the north. So we have a potential for mid-air collision there. Right. So that air traffic control tower, in my mind, the primary reason was safety. Now, secondarily, actually, there's three reasons. Secondarily, it provides opportunity for businesses that corporate businesses that won't come into an airport that does not have an air traffic right. control tower. And then, in addition to that, the tower now can mm-hmm. vector aircraft away from noise-sensitive areas like Charbonneau, which they do.
Follow up real
yes,
quick.
Sir.
I'm sorry. So the difference between Troutdale, which is not a through-the-fence, and Aurora, which is basically that at Troutdale, you do have industries, but they're outside, and they don't directly have access to the runways.
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Gorsuch, that is correct.
Okay.
At Troutdale is a busy airport in its
right.
own right. It has a lot of flight training
yes,
from a Hillsboro-based business. That
right. We have the
really
helicopter folks out
ballooned
there.
The number
yeah.
of operations at Troutdale to up over 100,000. It's become a very busy airport, too.
And one last. And so having the ability to do through the fence really is it's very important. Those groups that you listed, those industries, probably wouldn't be there without it. Is that correct?
They probably would not be. It's the right environment with the right business opportunists there. And for us, it's our most revenue-generating airport because of the through-the-fence operations.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything else? We will have plenty of time to revisit this when the bill actually arrives during the session. So thank you all for your very thoughtful questions. And I'm sure we will be hearing from the folks at Aurora when the time comes and be able to ask them questions as well. Mm-hmm. So there's one other component, I believe, to what you're trying to do here today. So please proceed. That was part one. Now we'll go to part two.
Okay. And that was quite a high-flying adventure.
It was. We appreciate your patience, Director.
The second issue is we've had a statute on the books for many, many years that requires pilots to register as pilots in the state. And in that is a clause that we had not enforced because we didn't think it applied. And that clause was that pilots from out of the state that fly in here commercially, we never applied that they would have to register as pilots in the state of Oregon. It would be the equivalent of a driver in Washington that comes into the state of Oregon and now has to have an Oregon driver's license. Mm-hmm. We had an employee that changed positions and read literally that she had to apply this statute. I checked with DOJ, and she, in fact, was right. Mm-hmm. And because she applied it, the National Business Aviation Association got up in arms and, in fact, called and wrote letters to many state legislators in Oregon. I fielded probably 20 phone calls from different legislators or staff members, and we determined that it wasn't a very good thing to be doing to charge pilots that come transiently to do commercial operations in the state. So this is a striking of that clause, section 2837.020, paragraph 1. It just strikes the clause that requires us to have to register pilots out of state. And that's the sum and substance of the change.
Director Swecker, does this line us up with other states now?
This does line us up with
aberration.
Very few other states, by the way, actually register pilots. You may have seen most recently that the FAA is now requiring drone pilots to register, but that's at the federal level, and the FAA licenses pilots, but there are only one, two, maybe three states that register pilots, and we're one of them.
And so pilots in Oregon not only register at the federal level and they register with us, and how many other states are doing that?
I would say maybe two other states that register pilots at all, okay. Maybe three. Right. I could give you an exact count, and I will do that as a follow-up.
Thank you. Questions? We do call this the fix-it interim. Thank you, Director Swecker. I don't believe we have any more questions, so we appreciate you being here today, and we'll look forward to seeing you again soon. We'll move now to the third part of our informational meeting this morning, and call up Mr. Mather. We look forward to a project update. A lot of things have happened during this storm season that has been upon us, and I asked Mr. Mather to come and give us an update on what's been happening around the state and what ODOT is doing to mitigate some of these unfortunate things that have occurred, and tell us how we're doing. So welcome again, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Good morning. Good morning again. I'm going to walk through a few projects, talk about some fires from last summer, and then talk about some of the damage we've seen from snow and rain just in the last month. And so I'll give you a little variety of things. I've got a few videos in here, so hopefully technology will be my friend this morning walking through this. I start, I think, just about every update with the Sunrise Corridor project, just because it's a major project for us and it continues to proceed along well. We're anticipating in early summer that this will be open to traffic, and look forward to quite a ribbon-cutting ceremony. It's just been a project that the region, and specifically in the Clackamas area, folks have been long anticipating. Here you can see some of the recent photos. You can see the paving and the work is taking shape through the corridor.
The interchange, as you drive on 205, if you've seen the new structure, which carries 82nd Drive and now can actually directly connects 82nd Avenue to 82nd Drive, allowing that existing structure of the extension of the Milwaukee Expressway now will be the new connection to the Sunrise Corridor and provide that bypass. So many of the legs of that are open. You see additional bike ped facilities in that interchange to help cyclists and pedestrians navigate through this area. So all's well with this project, and look forward to early summer having a ribbon cutting on this project. Again, this is $100 million of JTA funds, $130 million total project. Kerr Contractors out of Woodburn is the contractor on this project. This is a project that we talked about a couple sessions ago, where we did the variable speeds on 217. I just want to give you a quick report on some of the results that we're seeing as a result of this. During this last year and a half that this has been in place, we've seen a dramatic increase in traffic in general, and specifically on the freeways throughout the metro area, 217 included in that. So it's been hard to do a really direct apples and apples comparisons, just because during this time period we've seen a dramatic increase. But we've seen some benefits. For a very modest investment with this project, we've seen a lot of the benefits that we anticipated. First being safety was our primary goal, not just to reduce crashes, but also to reduce congestion. A large component of congestion is because of small accidents that happen. And so if we can reduce those, we can reduce congestion. We've seen about a 20% reduction in crashes. A lot of those are fairly minor fender benders, but we do have seen a reduction also in fatalities as well as serious accidents through the corridor. We've seen an increase of 5% of throughput through the area. So as you drive 217, you probably don't notice any different. But as we measure it, we're measuring there's 5% more traffic getting through during a given time period than we did before this. So the traffic is moving smoother. As traffic engineers, we study traffic similar to how you study water dynamics. And the smoother you can make it, the more you can get through a specific area. And so the smoother we make this with the speeds and warning drivers to move to a speed and warning them of crashes ahead, so forth, we can keep that flow smoother and actually get more traffic through the same amount of lanes. We've also seen an increase in predictability. So this is a little hard to explain, but when you travel 217 or any portion of the freeway system, you allow yourself probably the worst case you've experienced to get to your meeting or get to the airport or get to where you're going. What we've been able to do is narrow that down by about 10% of that predictability. So now if you visualize again a bell curve, we've tightened that bell curve up by about 10% in your predictability. So if you're thinking you've got to be at a meeting, you don't want to be late for that meeting, and you've allowed maybe in the past you've allowed 45 minutes for that, well, we've taken about 5 or 10 minutes off of that, in that you can now rely on a more predictable time to get through it. It's part of that smoothing and part of that reliability that we've seen in the corridor. So we've seen results. We're going to continue to monitor the specific crash warning signs that we've had at the 270 as well as the intersection with 26. I've also seen reductions about 50% in those particular locations where we've got those dynamic warning signs that go on with weather conditions. They've been beneficial. So our strategies, while low cost, are having the benefit cost kind of that we were expecting in this corridor.
Vice Chair Gorsuch has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the picture that we see here, so we have the dynamic signs that change the speed limit. Are we also talking about those the signs that tell you, minutes to destination points, like minutes to the I-5 interchange or to I-84 and 205? Is that part of that system?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, yes, it's all part of the same system. That is more for driver information and for allowing drivers to make alternative decisions. If you see that you've got delays ahead, then you can make a decision, depends on your destination and whether you want to take an alternative route or not. The exact correlation that has to the statistics I gave you are probably hard to quantify.
Yeah.
More of what we're quantifying is just that smoothness of traffic that we've seen in the corridor.
Well, and quick follow-up.
Yes.
I use that all the time, whether to take 205 or whether to stay on I-5 to connect up to I-84. And those things, at first I thought, oh, you know, why is this going to be helpful? But it actually is very beneficial to look at that and gauge which path will work best for me. So I think these are marvelous, innovations.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Another major project we have from the Jobs and Transportation Act is the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. This is about a $240 million total project. $190 million of that has come from the Jobs and Transportation Act. Again, this is a piece of a larger project that we went through the environmental process with. The upper map shows the larger project. The insert there at the bottom shows the smaller project. The area between Highway 219 and then back towards Dundee is under construction. I'll have a picture of those here in a minute, but we've divided that into half, where Hamilton Construction is doing the left half on the picture, and the right half is done by Wildish. I'll talk a little bit as we get to the end of this, but the intersection there with Wilsonville Road and then the last piece on Springbrook is the piece that's going to construction here in a few months and will be under construction this summer. Here's some of the pictures of the work that Wildish and Hamilton are doing. There's about 12 structures that they're building over creeks and roadways. Work is proceeding well. Both contractors are doing just an outstanding job for us. The viaduct that's being built through Newburgh between the paper mill is about a half-mile-long viaduct, a pretty impressive structure, and is well underway. The last piece we have is this connection with where the bypass connects into Wilsonville Road or at 219. We've had many discussions with the neighborhood groups on Wilsonville Road as well as with the city. In fact, the City Planning Commission met last night to talk about this. They moved a resolution to the City Council to support our existing design, which is the through-through design. But they also had quite a discussion about wanting to come to a win-win solution. And they, in their recommendation, they asked the City Council to delay the City Council meeting in February till March to allow time for all parties to come together and to find a better solution than what their resolution is. So we'll hopefully there's some promise in that we can come to something that all parties can agree to.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Pioneer Mountain, Eddyville, again, a project that I report on regularly just because of the high-profile nature of the project and the complexities that we've had to deal with the project. But it continues to proceed well. We had a good summer of work, and I'll share with you some of the photographs of the work that's been going out. There's a very impressive operation that the contractor has. The excavator that you see here in the picture, that scoop and a half of that will fill a regular 10-yard dump truck. So pretty amazing operation to see them move the amount of earth that they have. This shows you kind of a before and after. The picture labeled 2014, the fill that we're building there was half done in 2013, so we let it set over one winter, and then this last summer, the one on the bottom, you can see we're up to final grade. We're going to let that sit through the rainy season again, let it settle, and then we'll be doing final work. The good news is the new alignment is still on schedule for ribbon cutting in about 8 or 9 months. Of this, we still have some work to do. Here's another picture of the work. It's pretty spectacular stuff. You've seen the top of the picture, the big cut that they went through and took all that material out of that cut and moved it into the fill. This is actually not even the biggest fill on the project. There's pretty impressive work.
Well, do you have any idea how many yards moved?
2.5 million. Yeah, one of the fills has a million yards in it. The first picture I showed you, there's a million yards just in the one fill by itself.
A lot of operators.
Yeah. So the final piece we have is now connecting the west end of the project to the existing alignment. That work, because we'll be doing work under traffic, will carry us into the 2017 construction season for completion. We'll be, as I said earlier, the new alignment will be open to traffic this coming fall. fall, but we'll have work that'll happen in 2017 at this intersection. You can see in the inset pictures, you come off the new alignment, you're going to be heading into a very sharp curve. Mm-hmm. And so we've just built this very high-speed modern highway, and so we want to correct that curve before we complete the project so we don't just transfer a safety project. And back to you, the trees in the upper left or in the top of the inset picture, they're going to start falling those trees on Monday in preparation mm-hmm. for the work that'll happen this spring and summer.
Thank you. Any questions?
Project we've been doing up on Mount Hood. This is a safety project in that corridor. We've had a number of accidents, crossover accidents, run-off-the-road accidents, or crashes, and we have a project to address those. Here's some of the work that we've been doing in the curves. It's really to kind of soften those curves. We're going to extend the passing lane. We're going to widen the roadway so we have wider shoulders, as well as having enough room for a center divider in the corridor and improve safety.
Paul, are those weather-related? Is that more often in the winter than the summer, or what?
Madam Chair, it's year-round. We see them in the wintertime.
What do you attribute that to?
We see them year-round. Just speed in the corridor, the sharpness of the curves. The volume of traffic we have in the area. As we've talked before, I think in this committee, but just about the increase in crashes that we've seen during the last year as the economy has improved, gas prices have gone down. We've seen just an uptick in crashes and trying to get a handle on exactly why those are happening. We're struggling with one of our ideas is distracted drivers is a big piece of it. People are using their devices, doing other things in their vehicles, and not paying the attention maybe they need
to. But speed tends to be a factor?
Clearly, yeah. Speed is a factor as well. Yeah.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mather, I travel this corridor quite a bit, and the one thing that I've noticed, and I don't know if the newest construction has changed this, but the nighttime ability to see the lanes has been incredibly bad. Is that part of improving that? Because we really don't seem to have, unless it's changed, but in the last, up until maybe the last few weeks, I've noticed that there really aren't even the little reflective bumps in the lanes, which I think could be part of the traffic crashes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, that's something that we, this time of year, struggle with, especially in the mountain corridors where we use the abrasive sands and so forth to clear the roadway. Mm. That has a very negative effect on the striping and just wiping it off the roadway. But that's something we should be addressing. I'll follow up with our folks to make sure that we have the best we can in these conditions to get some better markings up there, because that's something.
Especially when it's dark and wet, it's hard to see those
lines. I would suggest if it's speed related too, I wonder how our public safety works into this and how many troopers we have out on the roads making sure that people are keeping speeds down. I don't know if you care to comment, but I mean, is there a factor there that we just don't have enough folks out there monitoring?
Madam Chair, just in our discussions with OSP and just comparisons with other states, we had this discussion when we were talking about raising the speed limits.
That's right.
That's clearly and enforcement is a big part of it. I mean, we talk about enforcement, we talk about engineering solutions, we talk about education solutions. There's different ways to approach the safety question, and you got to approach it from all fronts.
It's very comprehensive.
Yeah.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Paul, on this corridor in particular, you mentioned the potential for installing median barriers. Does that mean some of the cable barriers we see closer into Sandy might extend out, or is that just on the curves themselves?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Davis, in this area, because we're in a snow zone, it probably won't be the cable barriers. It'll be a center divide concrete barrier just because it works better in a snow zone. But you will see throughout I don't know the exact limits through here, but in the areas that we've seen a history of crossover crashes is where we're putting the concrete barrier.
Great. Thank you.
If my technology works here, I've got a short video to show you. One of the challenges that we've had, and it'll give you a preview to what you're going to see, is we've got to basically blow away the mountain. And you've got to do that while you have traffic. And so the contractor has gotten very proficient at knowing how much explosives to use so you can measure.
That's good.
That's very helpful.
the amount you can clean up in about 20 or 30 minutes and get traffic and get back traffic open. Back. And so they're doing about two or three of these blasts a week and just getting down to, and a couple times they've misjudged that, and so it's like, you know, delays have been
a little longer.
But they've gotten really proficient at doing this, and I'll show you just a quick video of them doing some of this work.
Oh,
nice.
Wow.
Here come the dozers.
Wow.
Okay. Dust settles.
Got a lot of equipment out there.
Yeah, this is what they've got over here. That is
poop and go.
Yeah. And really measuring the amount of explosive find this in a way to get traffic back moving again.
And also get the components small enough so that they're not damaging the roadbed and that they can scoop it up fast. Yeah, it's quite technical, isn't it?
Yeah, so they're doing, you know, during, you know, kind of the high production, they're doing two or three of those a week.
And how long will this project last, Paul?
It's got one more summer, ma'am.
One more summer.
It's about half done.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
So here's a picture showing what we call map curve there at the bottom.
Yeah. Mm. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Another project that's been challenging for us is the Salt Creek Tunnel Project. This is on Highway 58 between Eugene and Central Oregon. This project literally is on the face of a cliff, a 2,000-foot almost vertical cliff that we have these half viaducts, we call them, then leading into the Salt Creek Tunnel. We needed to replace four viaducts, two on either side of the tunnel, as well as lower the tunnel to allow taller, wider loads to get through the tunnel. We did a contract a few years, 2 years ago, through our traditional low bid process. And the contractor that was the successful low bidder on the project really struggled with the complexities of this project. You have a very tight window in the summertime. Again, you're in a snow zone. A very tight window in the summertime to do the work and some very complex work in getting it done. And from a schedule and a sequencing standpoint, really struggled. And after the 2 years, they weren't completed with the project. We sat down with the contractor and came to agreement to terminate the contract. And then we went back out with a bid through a different process and made sure that we had qualifications. So rather than through a low bid process, we went with best value and able to take the qualifications of the contractor. And the second contractor came in and completed the project just this last summer.
Well, I recall that this project actually involved road closure at one point in time. Something occurred?
A couple of things. Originally, it was planned in the original contract. We had closures that were planned for several days for the tunnel work. Those went relatively smoothly. In fact, the original contractor was able to find ways to limit those closures less than what we had originally anticipated. This last summer, we had some issues with a subcontractor doing the flagging that caused another closure.
And
this
that's
summer.
Resolved. That's
That's been resolved. So I got another video here to show you just a little detail on this project.
Salt Creek Tunnel up on 58.
What we're doing right Eugene now and today
major
is a grind inlay of striping. We grind down 3/16 of an inch and fill back in below finished grade, approximately 1/16 of an inch to maybe 1/8 of an inch, just to prevent snow plows from ripping up all of our striping.
Okay. That's part of your striping question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mark Boyce, work for ODOT as an inspector. I'm up here on Oregon 58, Salt Creek Viaducts, Phase 2. The end of project was slated to be in spring of next year. But the contractors got together and we built, actually demoed and built, two complete bridges. All the contractors I've worked with out here have done a bang-up job. The difference is that They had the iron to put on the ground. They had the personnel to go with the iron. The way they staged their construction outfit put them out ahead, you know, as far as time sequencing and getting the job done. They cared about what they were doing, and it shows in their the craftsmanship, the expertise that they put into this. It's awesome. I mean, even just the little things, getting these 3-2 braille posts perpendicular to the world and making care that most of the grout pads are even. The traveling public doesn't look at that. It just looks nice. You know, it's and it does look nice. I am very proud of this one. To be a part of this whole project, I'm really kind of sorry to see this one end, to be honest with you.
He may be sorry, but I think...
You're on record, Mr. Mather, of not being sorry. Yes.
Project and the delays, and but it is a nice-looking project at the end of the day here.
So did that one come in early?
Back to back to my presentation. So there's just a nice photograph of the of the tunnel and the bridge that they built. One of the bridges. Another project I just wanted to highlight was the work that we just started this last week on Interstate 5 south of Highway 38, the section of freeway just north of 38. Those will remember we had some issues with about a year and a half ago with long delays. Again, as we're trying to keep up with the increase in traffic and then designing and staging our projects in a way that accommodates those, we've put learnings from those in place for this next project right adjacent to that, and I anticipate this one to go much better. One of the things that we're doing is building a climbing lane as part of this project, which will allow us to have an extra lane going uphill during construction, which should help immensely in this project.
Thank you.
So in terms of fires, just from last summer, just to give you an update, I was in Ways and Means earlier talking about some limitation increases that we need for some of the work we've done. One of the more impactful fire that we had was actually just south of John Day, the Canyon Creek fire on Highway 395. Most of the time when we're dealing with fires, it's because of smoke. It's not really damage to the highway. But this fire was so hot and so fast moving. You'll see some pretty spectacular pictures of the damage to the highway. This is at our maintenance facility in Canyon City, where we actually were getting ready to evacuate at one point in the fire. But, you know, burned up the guardrail posts, signs, the guardrail itself. In many places, the guardrail was just left hanging and the posts had dead, burned. It took us the better part of a week. We had crews from around the state. We had contractors just trying to get the danger trees down so we could open the highway back up last summer. Mm. Since that time, we've been getting ready for the winter, because what's going to come next is this, the snow melts, mm-hmm. and you have the spring fall, you're going to have way more runoff than the system is designed to handle. You'll see a smaller culvert there on the right of the bigger culvert. That's the old culvert. You see it was damaged during the fire as well, but we're putting in a much bigger, mm-hmm. much bigger culvert, so we don't lose the road, as we anticipate to have a lot more runoff. Because of the fire in, mm-hmm. in here. Here's a finished picture. You'll notice we fill the bottom of the culvert a little bit to provide salmon habitat or fish habitat going through the creek. Just a shot of the work as well as the burned sign, but pretty spectacular fire. I had a chance to be out there just a few days after watching the crews deal with this. I've been on a lot of fires before, but just the intensity that this one burned was very impressive to see the damage throughout this canyon.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, and Paul, thanks for your work on this. I received a call from one of my constituents in John Day about that project. And they raised some issue about the space between the road and the guardrail, and about having something had to be redone. Are you familiar with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I am. We moved very quickly because of the snow that was coming. We had to get emergency authority contracting to get somebody out there. And when we put in our rush to get the project done, the guardrail was actually put in too close on the corner at Vance Creek. If you're familiar with where Vance Creek is, the switchback corner there, we've gone now and moved that back, added to the fill and moved that back out. So the problem has been corrected.
and follow up. There was one other issue raised, and that had been the length of time that that road was closed. And I don't recall the exact assertion other than that, that it was closed and there's no good way around unless you want to go through Bend.
Right.
And so that's 300 or 400 miles. So what was the, maybe you could share with us the speed at which you moved the project to try to avoid that closure.
But Madam Chair, Representative Bence, again, the issue is we're running against the clock from Mother Nature before it started snowing. Typically, we would stage this in a way we would allow traffic to move through. It would take a month or two to perform that work under traffic. Because of our need to get this culvert in, we actually closed the highway for, I want to say, 8 or 9 days. I can't remember exactly the time, but roughly a week we closed the entire highway.
If I may, I think it was longer than that.
Okay. I may have the time up. But it was 8 or 9 days is what I want to say, maybe 10 days. But we had the contractor working around the clock, putting in not only this culvert, there's another major culvert that was put in, and then got the highway back open. We had quite an outreach with the community to share what we were doing. So I don't think we surprised anybody, but I think there was clearly a hardship, again, on the community after they just went through the fire.
Right, if I may. So there was a, right, because there's so much of a link between John Day Canyon City and then as you drive up that road to the space up on top,
right.
Because most people have joint operations that are on both ends of that particular stretch of road. So to the extent that, and perhaps you've already pointed out to the community, the amount of time you were able to save as a result of speeding up your operations,
right.
That would be helpful. If you've already done it, then yay. But just so that the ODOT's reputation is not made worse than it was by virtue of that exercise, that would be a really good idea.
Madam Chair, Representative Bent, that's a good suggestion. I'll make sure we double our efforts to make sure the community knows why we had to take the approach we did in closing the roadway.
Right, but if I may, but the important part is telling everybody that in normal course of events, this would have taken 15 weeks. As it was, it took, I heard 12 days, but I don't know if that's right or not. But show that you'd moved heaven and earth to speed things up. That would be really a good idea.
Good.
And then to the extent you can show how much more money it cost as a result of that, you should call that out and say the state stepped up and dumped all this money in here to shorten that period of time so the community isn't just wandering around wondering, because it's crazy to allow that to happen when we have all these
right.
good efforts
right.
and it's simply not explained.
Mm-hmm.
And then one final, my understanding, were you guys asked to go up and breach the dam? Did you guys do the actual work on the breaching of the dam, Canyon Meadows Dam, up the John Day?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think so. It might have been, but I did not hear that. I can check for you, but I in our various reports and discussions about our work on the fire, I don't ever recall us being asked to do that, but it could have been.
Okay. If I may, the fear, of course, is, and now that they have 3 feet of snow, it's a justified fear,
mm-hmm.
that when that all melts all at one time, that water will come rushing down and pretty much destroy
right.
Canyon City and all the roads alongside the
right.
river.
Right.
And there's not a whole heck of a lot one can do about it because all the trees are gone.
Right.
I have no clue what ODOT is doing in anticipation of this other than making culverts bigger. I mean, I don't know what you can do, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a community problem. We're going to be working with the community to help, but it's going to have an impact this spring, later this winter, as all that snow melts in Kansas City and in John Day. I think that's the kind of the other chapter of this disaster is you're going to see the impact from the runoff, as you described.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Please proceed.
So we turn from fire to ice. Dan Metz is our High Cascade supervisor up near Diamond Lake. Dan is about 6'4". That's the amount of snow we received in about a 3-week period in December. That's about nine feet of snow is what they had in about a 3-week period. What happens when you get 9 feet of snow, wet snow, combined with wind, you get trees coming down in a very dangerous situation, not just for motorists, for our workers out there trying to clear the trees. You get trees interlaced with snow that you can't run your plows, and you get workers, fallers out there trying to buck the trees up that are covered with snow. So it's literally a hand-to-hand combat almost, and moving front-end loaders and moving fallers together to try to reopen the highway. This just gives you an idea of kind of their battle plan when they were trying to reopen the highway. So in the very center of that map is about Diamond Lake. Highway 97 is on the right side, but 138 and 230 as they come up towards Diamond Lake and Crater Lake. You can see that almost from a battle plan's perspective, we had contractors working. We brought in crews from around the state and each gave them a section working alongside of power companies trying to restore power. We had people stranded up at Diamond Lake Lodge. It was quite an effort for about a week and a half that they, again, trying to clear these roads and clear a path to get power restored and get people out of the Diamond Lake Lodge. All that snow came, you know, as a form of rain to the coast. Here's a culvert failure that we had on the Carpenterville Highway in Curry County. Damage on Highway 30 up along the Columbia in Columbia County, just a numerous slides and trees coming across the road. This is on 101 near Wheeler. This sink actually ended up going down about 4 feet before it was done, and we're still working on a repair there. A number of just kind of pop-outs and slides along 101. This culvert failure actually isolated the town of Oceanside for several days, as this highway is the only road in and out of Oceanside. You remember we talked last spring a lot about culverts, and this is what happens when you don't have good culverts and you get, you know, a lot of rain. Here's another culvert failure outside of Astoria.
I think the number's in excess of 30,000 culverts that we have been considering working on. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Here's the work. I just had the inspector take a picture yesterday of the work they're doing at this location to replace about two 6-foot culverts. So it's quite a bit of work that you've got to do to get the highways back open. Another failure near Hebo on 22. Mm. Also, just the sinks and slide, kind of the normal winter on the coast, and many of the sections are very high slide-prone areas, massive slides. It's just not cost-effective to try to fix those. We're more in a maintenance mode, but each one of those start moving when we get a lot of rain. Utilities are impacted in a lot of cases. Erosion along the roadway. So just some pictures of that. Just the last one I wanted to close on was the Highway 42 slide that we have. The Highway 42 runs from Roseburg to Coos Bay. This is in the center.
And I will note this is a major freight corridor.
Yeah, for the port of Coos Bay. This slide happened right at the county line. We're standing just barely in Coos County. Where this is taking, you see the snow coming down as it was raining. Again, the record rainfall we had throughout the month. Notice in the picture of the guardrail again, where that guardrail has actually been pulled away from those guardrail posts as the ground moved. I was out there, and the tension on that guardrail was just immense. You could just flick it with your finger and just kind of hear it almost, the tension as it popped away from those guardrail posts. I've got another video here. This is actually with a drone, so you'll be able to see the perspective of the slide and just how I'll turn the music down. It's a little obnoxious, I think, but this just gives you a sense of the damage. When you see the pictures, you see this kind of this corner where the slide has damaged the highway, but in a minute here you'll get a bigger perspective of just how massive this slide is.
And I'll just note as well that this section of highway has been problematic for decades, this county line set of curves, and ODOT's been working on this for a very, very, very long time. It continues to be problematic, and there's a large project happening here now.
You'll notice there's a logging road right here. When I was up there, I noticed their culvert had failed right at the top of the slide, and maybe one of the contributing factors to... again, a culvert failure could be a contributing factor to putting more water into the slide. Jeez. So we've had about 3 inches of rain just this week. And this slide has been fairly stable. We've taken about a half a dozen of dump truck loads of material that have come down. We will continue to work on removing the slide as we are safely able to through the winter. Meanwhile, we are flagging traffic through here. There's about a 5 to 10 minute delay for traffic to get around the slide. It was closed for about 10 days until we let the slide stabilize and able to get equipment in there to open at least one lane under gravel to get traffic through. As you said, it's a major freight corridor. The detour is going Highway 38. It's almost 100 miles out of the way detour to get around. So it was important for us to at least establish a connection for that freight traffic to get through.
Sensitive to Representative Bent's comments, when you do close a highway, for us who are kind of out in the hinterlands, the workarounds and the detours aren't 5 miles. They're 100 miles. And it puts all of that truck traffic on Highway 38 instead of having it balanced between 38 and 42. So everything has to come through Elkton to the coast instead of. So it creates a significant amount of problem. And the geography of this particular section of the Coquille River is a problem. So we appreciate the work that ODOT did to get it open as quickly as you did, sir. Is there, and I'd be really curious as to what your engineers are saying now that this very large piece of hillside has moved, as to what the potential stability of this is in the future. And it's right on the river. What are they telling you?
Well, they're telling us that the major portion of the slide there in the center, the part that came out onto the highway, is really a term they use is released all its energy, so it's kind of done what it's going to do. If you see kind of tucked around there to the right, there's more of a debris flow element to the slide. They're more worried about that portion of the slide and more kind of coming down in a debris flow all of a sudden type of event. So we're watching that, especially as these rains happen in nighttime when the flaggers are out there watching that closely. But we're going to have to get things to dry out to really understand more what's going on to really get a solution going forward. We're going to work on that part of the slide that I talked about that kind of released its energy. We're going to start removing that material, again, as conditions allow.
And are there any issues with debris flowing into the river?
Madam Chair, we've had a little bit of that. We've had regulatory agencies out there, and we've been managing that. So far, it hasn't been a major problem.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yep. Good, that's all I have.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mather. Any follow-up questions? All right, we appreciate you putting that together for us. It's very helpful. And next, I'll call up Mr. McClellan from the Department of Motor Vehicles to give us an update on federal Real ID program compliance. And Mr. McClellan, I want to apologize to you. We had you on the agenda for December. Things got jammed up for us, and you were kind enough to postpone. I know you were keyed up in the Senate and here, and you were ready to go, and we sidetracked you. So my apologies for that, and we appreciate you coming now.
Thank you very much. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation, and I am here to give you an update, answer any questions you might have about the Federal Real ID Act. I don't have any entertaining pictures or videos. I've just been shown up by my peer within the Department of Transportation, but I'll do my best nevertheless. Mainly just to give you an update, there was an announcement last week from Department of Homeland Security dealing with access to commercial flights at airports and the use of state-issued driver license and ID cards. Mm-hmm. And just wanted to clarify what was announced. States' driver's licenses and ID cards will continue to be accepted by TSA as acceptable identification until January 22nd of 2018. They had announced previously that they would give states, that wouldn't happen before 2016, and that they would give states at least 120 days of notice. Well, they've given us 2 years of notice, which was much appreciated. And they've also indicated that they're going to do their own public notice processes over the next year and a half, gradually increasing the notice to individuals that your state's cards may not be accepted after January 22nd of 2018. So with that, you're going to potentially hear from some of your constituents with some questions about, is Oregon compliant? Will Oregon become compliant? You know, those types of questions. So you have my testimony. They have been going through a phased enforcement process. This law passed in 2005. The president signed it into law in May of 2005, and initially had a three-year time frame. And each time we'd get close to that 3 years, Homeland Security would add another year or two or three. And in 2013, they got serious, and they identified a series of steps that they would go through of increased scrutiny of states issued driver license and ID cards at federal facilities. And they set up dates, and they have followed through on each one of those dates, gradually going deeper and deeper into secure federal facilities, military bases, nuclear power plants, those types of things, for any states' cards that have not been deemed compliant. And they pushed off the TSA piece, because that's the biggest impact, really, to the public until later. In that time frame, they also offered opportunities for states to submit status reports. Where are you at in meeting the 42 requirements that they have in their regulations? And we have done that dutifully for the last 3 years, and they've granted extensions, one-year extensions in October of each of the past 3 years. We're currently in an extension that would expire in October of this year. We could apply again for another extension, but that one expires. But because we have the extension, our cards are continuing to be accepted in federal facilities, nuclear power plants, military bases, and obviously at the airports as well. That's kind of separate at this point. We've gone just about as far as we can go administratively as an agency in meeting those requirements. The last policy position that this body has taken was in 2009. It was following upon the previous year a bill that passed, Senate Bill 1080, that had to do with legal presence requirements, proving that you're in the country legally in order to obtain a driver's license. In 2009, our agency came back with a proposal, a bill, to change a few laws to bring us closer into compliance, and a budget request for the funding to move ahead with that. Not only were both of those rejected, we ended up with Senate Bill 536, which is in your materials. It's a short two-page bill, so it doesn't take too long to read. But it's got a handful of hurdles that any state agency would have to overcome if it were to try to comply with the federal ID. Some have perceived that as a "we won't comply." It actually does provide a pathway, but it's a pretty tough one, actually. And as you look through that, you'll see that it requires that federal funds must be available to pay for it. It cannot be a state-funded activity. So you need federal funds. You need to ensure that there's security for and protecting personal identifiable information and protection of the security of our individuals, our citizens. It requires a cost analysis and some other types of reporting as part of that. We have not pursued any of those steps. I've given reports at least once a year for the past 8 years on this topic, and I've received no indication that the policy position in 2009 has changed. So barring that, we have gone gradually through administrative changes, some policy procedure type things that haven't required any cost on our part, that have enabled us to get these extensions. But as I said, we're pretty much coming to the end of that point. Some of the things that still remain for us to do. One of the biggest, I believe, is the imaging of the identity source documents that people present to prove who they are and that they're legally present. Birth certificates, immigration documents, Social Security cards. Today, our practice is to review those. Take a look at them, hold them, feel them, you know, look at them to see if they are truly what they pretend to be. But those are real documents. We hand them back to the person. We don't take a copy. There's no imaging kept of that. The federal regulations require that besides the application and any certifications that they've made, that those documents also be kept, the copies of those be kept as a record. We would expect some kind of statutory authority to do that, and there would be funding associated with that as well if we were to try to put that into place with our practices today. There's also a requirement for criminal background checks that are not just name-based, which we do today on new employees, but fingerprint-based. criminal background checks, and we did not do that.
This is on your employees.
On our employees, mm-hmm. any agents or contractors that we have that would have access to the information or have any involvement in the issuance of the ID cards or driver licenses. And that's a fairly big, I guess, as far as our employees go and hiring practices. There's also a requirement that we re-verify Social Security numbers as people come in to renew their driver's licenses and ID cards. We do it once, and once it's been confirmed, we don't require you to bring your card back in and have us do another check. Another regulation would be that you'd have to do it again, you know, at 8 years or a replacement card transaction or something like that, that you would have to do that type of a check. There's about seven in total, and three are just very administrative type things, you know, committing to marking compliant cards, committing to be in compliance, submitting a certification package. You know, those are pretty administrative type things. But there's three or four still that remain that I think we've reached about the limits that we can go administratively to achieve that compliance status that you may or may not want us to achieve. So,
Vice Chair Davis has a question. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for your testimony. With regard to the Social Security numbers, just to clarify, so the practice of DMV now is only to require proof on initial issuance, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's correct. On any renewal, it's not required?
It's not required.
The question that I had was, are they... Would could anybody who has a passport, does that meet all of their requirements?
Chair McEwen, Representative McClain, yes.
Okay, so if there's an expense to the state of Oregon to do this ID card, or the choice that everybody has to get a passport, mm-hmm. I mean, because that's a price that sounds like a lot smaller than what this would be, but I mean, they would accept that if our state says, you know, this is how much money it's going to cost, $10 billion to do this system.
Yes.
Plus, we're worried about some privacy issues. Do each of you want to just go get your own passport, and then we take that to the airport or wherever we're going? I mean, to me, this sounds extraordinarily expensive, and, you know, we don't have all that.
Representative McEwen, Representative McClain, Transportation Security Administration, TSA, accepts, of course, driver's licenses and state-issued ID cards. Passports, passport cards, global entry cards, U.S. military ID, airline or airport-issued ID, federally recognized tribal-issued photo ID. There's a few others on their website, but those are the biggest ones.
Military ID, I assume.
Military ID is on that list.
Yeah.
So there's an alternative, and that's been part of the conversation over the years is, well, if there's an alternative, and there really is no federal penalty as far as loss of highway fund monies or something like that for noncompliance, there's been a view that, well, they'll never follow through on this. But they have, the last 2.5 years, they followed through on the deadlines that they've set for other restrictions on access to federal facilities. I have no reason to believe they won't follow through on this latest deadline of 2018.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you concerned at all, I would assume that you are, about our archaic software systems that we have and the need for updates to those systems before you would ever even consider tackling keeping folks' Social Security numbers and all of this data?
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, I'm very concerned about that, and I came before you during the session requesting some funding for what we're calling our service transformation program, which is the replacement of these very old computer systems and getting into the 21st century. We're concerned about those types of things as well. We're in the process of moving from microfilm to digital imaging. I mean, that's how archaic we are right now, but just to be able to do that with the documents and the processes we have today, let alone to add something like this in our field offices, because it's assumed it would be done at the point of sale. At the field office, you would do the imaging of documents and retaining those copies centrally, some secure location.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. Looking at the implementation of motor voter, all of that, I think that it may not be a bad idea, and I think it is time that we invest in DMV, and that I like the idea of your staff having the background check simply because they do deal with very highly important documentation that folks care deeply about. So obviously there's a need for this, or this wouldn't have been passed by the president in 2005. So is it possible for DMV, though, to even begin to implement by 2018 if you were to be given the means to do that?
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, I don't have the means to do that right now, and there definitely would be trade-offs for us, some pretty significant things with IT work that we have in progress, including what you just approved for us to really transform and replace these very old computer systems. So it'd be a very, I think, some very difficult choices for us if we were asked to comply at this point. And you know, the limited resources that we actually have, the key people that we would have to redeploy to work on that, there would be some implications, I'm sure.
Mr. McClellan?
Yes, please, go ahead.
What have you done to, and maybe I missed this and you kind of already talked about it, but what have you done to put yourself in a position to be ready for 2018 if this were to happen as an agency?
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, the extensions have been what we've done. Primarily, some of the changes that we've made, I mentioned procedurally a few things that we've done, some policy changes. Putting forward anything that might look like we're moving toward compliance, we've included in those letters to buy us some time, basically. That's been our approach. It's been more the buying of time. There are requirements around security features on the cards. We don't meet every single one of those. So we've tied that into a contract, a system replacement that we had already planned to do in the next year and a half. So we've claimed that as moving toward compliance, because the new card that we issue in a year and a half from now under a different contractor will be compliant. And we've told Homeland Security that, and they said, okay, check the box. You've done it. You've committed to do it, and that puts you into that side of the equation as being compliant for that particular requirement. So that's the type of thing we've done to try to move us closer. There's still certain things that are statutory. The provisions from Senate Bill 536 in 2009 are still there. And so there's limits to how far an agency like mine can go without some prescriptive or specific statutory authority to do something. And so we're kind of caught at that point right now.
Because I think folks are going to be disappointed if they can't use their driver's license in 2018 to get on an airplane. While I get the what Representative McClain is saying on the passport side, not everybody can afford a passport. It's not cheap. But most folks have a driver's license, so I think we're going to get some. I think we're going to get some pushback.
Representative McClain, the map that you gave us, you know, that shows mm-hmm. us the colors are a little bit hard to distinguish on a couple of these. Do you know? Do we have 15 states that are in compliance, or how many states are in compliance?
Representative McClain, there are 23 states that are in the compliant status. There are another 23 states that have this extension that Oregon has through October of this year. And then one other state, I think it's New Hampshire, has an extension like ours that expires in June. So there's 24 there. There's only six jurisdictions that have been identified as non-compliant and whose residence cards are not accepted in those federal facilities. And that includes Washington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
Washington's on that in that list. Washington has a, and there are two or three states that have this, an enhanced driver license or an EDL that they issue. So you go through a little different process. You get a card that has some different features on it. That card has been, and that process has been deemed compliant by Homeland Security. So those who choose to go that path, the residents that choose to go that path and pay a different fee, can get a compliant card in Washington. But their standard issued card is not compliant. They don't have a legal presence requirement, for example.
So the customer can ask for the enhanced card and pay extra for it. Which is kind of not everybody can afford a passport argument, but do you know what the price differential is?
I'm just looking for some of that. I had some of that here.
But isn't Washington's system updated, though?
And, Mr. McClellan, I don't know if you have a ballpark figure in mind, but I would be really curious as to what dollar figure is attached to. I mean, I know it's complex because we have a system that we're upgrading now to a certain level. What would
hopefully the federal government have to invest in a system like this to make us compliant and make us meet all these standards? And are other states investing their own money? I assume the federal government is not supporting any states in this endeavor.
Chair McEwen, there were specific grants for this purpose available for 3 different years. I think I've actually got that in my testimony from Homeland Security. So states could apply. Some were just automatically granted funding for it. And then it stopped after those 3 years. There is federal money that could be used under some general Homeland Security grants that I believe our Emergency Management and Military Department take advantage of. That we have not approached them to see if they'd share any of that money with us. But I think that's about the only place where there might be federal money that could be used for this.
There a reason that we are not approaching them? What authority do you need to
Chair
make
McEwen,
that ask?
It comes back to whether the legislature wants us to comply. How urgent do you feel this is, and what steps would you like us to take? I mean, that really comes down to that.
Okay.
Is it worth our effort to try to get those funds that I'm sure are used for very important Homeland Security type purposes in the state? It's just a tough trade-off there.
Representative Benz.
Thank you. Thank you for the report. Really interesting. My understanding is that if you have a passport,
you're fine.
Okay.
Yes.
You're okay. And then it seems like we've been kind of rope-a-doped into thinking that we don't have to do anything because we're going to get another extension. You're here telling us don't bet on it.
Yes.
That's what we're hearing.
That's really what I'm trying to get across to you, yes.
Yeah,
time for us to pay attention.
That means we have how many years until we can't get on a plane? Let's just use that as the example.
Representative Betts, it's 2 years.
2 years from right now.
From right now. Yeah. January 22nd of 2018 is what they've given us.
A week. Yeah.
Ooh, that week going off.
And the amount of money, excuse me, follow up, I'm sorry.
Yes.
The amount of money it would take, the chair just asked, for this state to meet the standard you think may be for real in 2 years would be, give us a number.
Chair McEwen, Representative Benz, it's been a few years since we've done what I would consider a full analysis of this, but a lot of assumptions have to go into it. So I'm giving you caveats here, but $8 to $12 million has been the figures that I've seen, and even in 2 years, I couldn't absolutely be sure that we would be ready with the changes that are identified here. I've seen other jurisdictions across the country achieve that compliance status with what we would consider not 100% full compliance, maybe closer to a substantially compliant standard. So there's some discretion here. And ultimately, it comes down to the Secretary of Homeland Security's judgment of whether a state has complied.
And follow up.
Yes.
And of course, the issue is how we get you the money, how long to compliance.
Yes.
Right. I mean, what's the space? Mm-hmm. I mean, we give you $12 million today, $20 million today. How long before we're compliant?
Representative Benz, my staff is saying 3 to 4 years. Yeah. Assume that much time. Now, that's assuming we don't get a lot of extra resources, that we don't stop what I consider some pretty critical projects in-house. More time than the 2 years, I think, that we have at this moment.
Mr. Davis and then Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So as I look at the requirements that still must be met, the big one seems to be the technology barrier and the security barrier that I think we would all want to see with respect to retaining digital copies of legal presence documents. Mm-hmm. With DMV initiating its technology computer upgrades right now, I understand we're in process now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be very helpful to get an estimate from ODOT and DMV about what an integrated approach would look like. I mean, I think a number of us probably have significant concerns with the idea of retaining these documents. We should explore multiple avenues here, but if we were to have to go through this, is there a way it could be integrated with DMV's technology upgrades? Because as I look at the other requirements, re-verifying lawful status, that's an administrative piece, probably adds some time to mm-hmm. customer transactions, requires a lot of repeat transactions because many people will come in for renewals without the necessary documents.
Mm-hmm.
Card design is going to be part of the new
yes.
system anyway. Fingerprint is really an internal HR matter for the department. and these other compliance matters. But so it seems to me the biggest piece is probably that technology upgrade.
Yes.
And perhaps perhaps this is the time. And follow up?
Yes.
My next question is, so our current deferral is through October 10th, 2016. Maybe you said this and I missed it. The next stage of enforcement is January 2018. There's a little bit of a donut hole there. What is the threat of occurring if we don't get the next deferral and before that next stage of federal enforcement?
So, Chair McEwen, Representative Davis, the donut hole that you referenced there is that period of time when our cards may not be accepted at secure federal facilities.
Mm. That's right.
Nuclear power plants, you don't have a lot of people go to those. The military bases
right.
across the world in the
right.
country.
Federal buildings in Portland.
Yeah, federal buildings, secure federal courthouses. We don't mm-hmm. have a lot of those even in Oregon.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
we have Oregonians that live in different places besides Oregon, too, which are affected by these standards. So, the challenge is to find more things that we can point to show progress. Progress is a big word I keep hearing from Homeland Security and their officials. You may still say you never will comply, but are you showing progress? Are you moving closer to the goal of hitting all 42 of these things? And any state that has shown sufficient progress, they have granted these extensions. So it's possible we would get another one later this fall. To give us another year, but I don't know what happens after that. I really don't.
Then we're done.
The other date that's in my testimony, I really need to point out to you is October of 2020. Even states that are issuing compliant cards will still have individuals within their jurisdiction that don't have a compliant card.
Right.
Because of 4-year expiration dates, and we have an 8-year expiration date. Mm-hmm. So even though your state is compliant and you're issuing compliant cards, a lot of people won't have a compliant card. So when they go to get on an airplane, they're not going to be accepted unless what Homeland Security will most likely be looking for is what they call their gold star. It's the indicator they've said they would like to see on a state's compliant issued card. So if you're bringing in a driver's license issued after a certain point in time that they've deemed you as compliant, you're going to, in addition to everything else on your card, you have a gold star, and I think it's the upper right corner that says, which is an indicator, this is a compliant card from a state that is compliant.
And that's just because they're out of a renewal cycle, is what you're
yes.
saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the closer you get to that date, mm-hmm. And the more people that want to have a compliant card, the bigger the impact on our field offices and our wait times.
Early renewal, is that what you're talking about?
People replace their card.
Replace their card.
It's not a renewal, but it's a replacement.
Replacement, right.
You know, they still have 3 years left on their driver's license, but they want to replace their card with this new star on it.
Vice Chair Davis.
Maybe we could work out a deal with TSA where we give them our shoes for the whole flight instead of having to comply with the card. So not just through security.
There we go.
Hey,
but if you
work.
Have global entry, you don't have to take your shoes off.
Ah, yes.
Oh.
TSA pre-check, your shoes stay on. So.
Wow.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Any other questions? This is very complex. I'm very glad you brought this to our attention.
Yeah.
This is something that I think we have some serious work to do. And I'm sorry you're behind. We've already lost a month because we didn't bring you in December. My apologies for that.
Right.
But I'm sure that we will be asking more questions and be hearing much more about this as we move along. Any other questions for Mr. McClellan?
He covered mine. He did.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I believe, Mr. Brennan, that exhausts our agenda for the day.
Certainly does, Madam Chair. We're good. Yeah, absolutely. So, I didn't. Just so y'all know, when the session starts, this committee will be Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 3 p.m., just like it was in 2015. That's the regular schedule for this committee during the short session. I believe it is. Not sure if this committee is going to be allowed to meet on the first day, and if it does, if it's going to be allowed to do bills. And I think we're going to have an advisory agenda that we can post the week before, which will allow us to do hearings on actual bills on that first Monday, February 1st,
all right.
session.
Hmm.
So.
All right. Anything for the good of the order? Right. On that note, yes, sir.
Just briefly, I'm going to be asking, and I think we discussed this as well, ODOT for some updates on implications for Oregon of the federal transportation bill that was passed at the end of 2015.
Yes.
We've received some emails from ODOT that's been very helpful about increased funding and what that might mean for the state, and then also I've asked for where Oregon might stand in relation to federal grant opportunities and matching funds.
Great, thank you. Anything else? We are adjourned. There are some bill backs here for bills if anybody's interested in signing on the committee bills that we're bringing forward.
And I've got these three for you.